On to the first concurrent of today. We're looking at life insurance commission reform, which is very topical after what we heard about this morning. I guess it's an extension of FOFA for best interests and making sure customers' interests are looked after and not just advisors. But today we're looking at the actuarial impacts of the life commission reforms. And we should have a great discussion. It's a 50-minute talk, as usual, so you all know from yesterday. Dale and Tyson will talk to us first, and then we'll have some question and discussion time. So I encourage you all to use the microphone in the middle of the room because this is being recorded. If you could introduce yourself and then ask a question, that would be great. And also afterwards, if you could fill out the online feedback form for the presenters, that would be great. So today we have Dale Jackson and Tyson Johnson with us from EY to talk to us. They've both done a range of consulting from pricing and product development through to valuation and supporting appointed actuaries. They've done M&A work and a range of different work, but more importantly, they're both very energetic people. Dale likes his soccer and Tyson likes his CrossFit. So given they're so neck and neck on everything, they did have to have an arm wrestle to see who went first. So here we've got Dale to kick us off. Thanks, Dale.
Thanks very much, Kim. Good morning, everyone. So there's been quite a bit of movement and discussion around life insurance commission reform over the last 18 months. Things appeared to be settling down just in time for this presentation, but then we didn't foresee an election being called just prior to the legislation actually being passed. So we are somewhat in limbo at the moment in terms of where the reforms are at, and please keep that in mind as we go through, because there are a number of references to a 1st of July 2016 start date. Things aren't set in stone just yet, and in particular the timing looks like being later than expected. So firstly, I just want to acknowledge that this is a very broad and deep topic. There's a lot of areas that we could go into, but we're not attempting to cover everything today. So we'll run things in three parts. Firstly, a brief overview of the changes, expected impacts, then going into more detail around assumption setting for lapse rates. We won't be going into detail around sales, expenses, pricing, capital requirements and so forth, but happy to take questions around those topics towards the end. And then finally, we'll be rounding out with a bit of crystal ball gazing regarding the future regulatory environment. So the key elements of the life insurance framework, or LIF, as many people like to abbreviate it as, are up on the screen. The key elements include the remuneration model, in particular caps on first year commissions, as well as extended clawback periods, an industry code of conduct, and the FSC has already given the industry a bit of a preview on this at the FSC conference in March. And a third key element there is an FSC standard on approved product lists, and that's one that we'll come back to in a moment. So, as I said at the start, the LIF legislation itself won't be passed before the 2nd of July election, so there is a bit of a holding pattern in terms of implementation, but the reforms themselves broadly have bipartisan support within the Parliament, so it is likely that they'll pass in some form shortly after. But nothing's ever certain. So there are a range of impacts expected. From the advisor's point of view, there's obviously a significant initial cash flow impact and a need to think about whether current business model remains viable, or whether they need to change and think about how they service their customers differently, and how they charge for their services and how they bring greater efficiency into the process. For insurers, there's an obvious need to have reviewed pricing and to support advisors through this change, and that is partially in terms of understanding the impacts on their business, but also helping with the improvements around productivity so that the remuneration model can work for all parties. For customers, we've got the question mark there because it's all a little bit less clear-cut. So most insurers we find aren't really finding the scope to reduce premiums as a result of the changes in the remuneration models. Basically, the additional trail commission offsets any benefit from lowering the first-year commissions. But this is a little bit different from insurer to insurer. But broadly, any pricing benefit is dependent on future retention benefits or reductions in lapse rates and future efficiency being brought to the process. So lastly, just listing out a few of the risks and unknowns as in terms of where we're at. As I mentioned, there is part of the LIFT package is the push to have a industry standard around approved product lists with a view to widening them. So two quite clear impacts from that are the value of institutionally owned distribution will reduce, you know, as the APLs are currently quite narrow. But, you know, this kind of change would obviously favour those who are already competing strongly in the IFA market. In terms of grandfathering, really just raising the question there, is there potential to use these grandfathering provisions to help advisors subsidise the drop-off in initial commission? So there is an element to the, I guess, draft regulation allowing certain arrangements that are pre-existing to be grandfathered. So there is that possibility. There's plenty of smart people in the room to think about how that could be used. But the obvious downside to all of that is, you know, it's potentially undermining the objectives of the LIFT framework. The third point there is very important as well, and it's one we'll come back to a bit later in the presentation. So the government has tasked ASIC to review the effectiveness of these reforms in 2018. The potential is there for further reform to happen and take the form of level commissions being mandated should that review not show significant progress in improving customer outcomes. So I'll leave it there for now and come back to you a little bit later. So for now, Tyson will move into some discussion around lapse rate assumptions.
Thanks for that, Kim and Dale, and good morning to everyone in the room. As Dale mentioned, I'll be talking about the actuarial implications. Now, the angle that we're taking on this is what are the actuarial implications for insurers, specifically through the impact on lapse experience, lapse analysis, and lapse assumption setting. To start with, we'll discuss a bit of an industry view. So Dale and I held discussions with a number of actuaries across the industry to get an idea about some of the expectation and proposed actions in light of the commission reforms. The first topic that we discussed was what is the expected change over the coming year, so the next 12 months, and we largely grouped them into three sort of buckets. So will there be an increase in experience, will it be relatively stable, or will there be a reduction? Now, going into it, we thought that maybe it would be skewed towards more the reduction side. But what was evident is that there was actually quite a lot of variability amongst the industry in where experience might go. And we asked ourselves, why is it that actuaries are expecting minimal change? Why is there this uncertainty? And we hypothesised a number of potential reasons, first of which may well be because in the back of everyone's minds, people knew that it would get to 1 July and it wouldn't actually be implemented. Number two, perhaps some of the expected improvements in lapse experience have already come through. So in the industry data we see over the sort of the last maybe 12 to 18 months, the average lapse rates have been coming down. And this is perhaps a reflection on greater regulatory scrutiny on advisor conduct, and that part of the anticipated improvement has already occurred. The third potential option is that the existing upfront business, at least in the short term, might be traded for the new LIF higher renewal commissions and increasing lapse rates in the short term. This is particularly relevant over the transition period, where the renewal commission will jump up and the initial commission slowly reduces. The next topic we discussed was, in light of these expected changes, are actuaries proposing to make any adjustments to assumptions, of course, from the effective date? In this case, we were, I guess, surprised to see very few proposing to make detailed adjustments at this point. And there was much more centralised around either making no adjustments or making high-level adjustments, particularly on the valuation side. Some were making more detailed adjustments to pricing. And I mean, I guess this is the sort of ingrained philosophy to setting assumptions, where assumptions aren't really changed until they're reflected in historical experience of X number of years. And in this case, it may result in a bit of a lagged effect if experience does work out to be different. So next, I'm just going to discuss a number of potential lapse rate outcomes. Now, we certainly don't have a crystal ball, and these are just a couple of simple scenarios that might happen, because it's useful to think about a couple of the drivers in particular. Now, even if lapse experience doesn't change in total magnitude, we do expect that it will change in the shape, particularly when expressed by a number of lapse drivers. So all we have on the screen there is what we would call a sort of a typical shape when expressed by duration. It's obviously the initial spike in lapse rates, tailing off to something a bit more consistent, a bit lower, as the policy duration increases. So it's useful to think about the drivers of this and what's driven by sort of the advisor impact and what's driven by the customer impact. So the advisor impact, really, I mean, I guess it's the churn which is driving that initial spike in lapses. The customer impact can be thought of, I guess, in two aspects. First would be customers not satisfied with the product, and that links back to advisor as well. And also the customer no longer needing the product. So that's more the pure customer impact. So the first scenario that we'll show is a fairly simple scenario where some of that advisor impact is addressed. So lapses are reduced during the clawback period. And then they, shortly after the clawback period, they trend to something consistent with what we're seeing now. The next scenario might look something like this, which is more of an optimistic outcome. So in this outcome, similar to the scenario one, part of the advisor impact is addressed, but also part of the customer impact is addressed. So we're seeing advisors, the churn's reducing, but we're also seeing customers who are more satisfied with their product and they're hanging on to it for longer. So this is obviously a better outcome for insurers and customers. Now, if we're going to show three scenarios, we have to show a more pessimistic outcome. Now, we can't ignore the fact that the proposed structure still has an initial commission that's three times higher than the renewal commission. So there is still some incentive for advisors to move their business around seeking that initial commission. So that could look like many different shapes. It could be simply the spikes move to the right, or it could be that shortly after the clawback period, experience just increases. And that's what we're seeing here. So in terms of the profitability outcomes, this scenario three is certainly a suboptimal outcome for all parties. Obviously, poorer lapses, bad for insurers. what's bad for insurers is generally bad for the customer through higher premiums. And the advisor impact is interesting. Given the new the renewal commission that's increased, there really is a benefit to those advisors with a long-term view for those that hang on to their policies, because when you discount it all back, the present value of the commission stream under the new structure is often higher than the existing arrangement. So in this case, the higher lapses will actually act as a detriment to advisors as well. Now, we'll just touch quickly on some other drivers of lapse experience. The previous slide considered how the shape of experience might change when expressed by duration, but insurers use a wide variety of other factors, some of which are on the slide there. And the factors that are likely to change are those that are impacted by, or those that drive the incentive to churn. So those are essentially factors that impact the size of the commission or the ability of the policyholder to be re-underwritten. So, you know, aside from the obvious ones like duration and commission structure, age will likely be an interesting one. So obviously premiums increase with age, but also the older you get, the higher the underwriting burden. So there could be some interesting shape changes going on there. And sum insured is the other one, which, similar to age, is driven by both, but it's more likely to be to impact the size of the premium and the size of the commission. One thing to note is that a number of insurers are currently using multiplicative loadings, and it's likely that if the shape does change for one or more of these factors, those loadings will likely need rebasing. In terms of actually analysing experience, we all know that there are a number of issues in analysing experience. Those aren't going to go away. And it's likely that we'll be faced with a number of additional challenges. Some are obvious. For example, you're going to need to be able to identify commission structure in the data. Hopefully everyone can do that now. But it goes maybe one step further than that. Insurers are likely writing some sort of hybrid product at the moment. And ideally we'll be able to identify a commission structure pre and post LIF in order to properly examine experience. Judgment versus a data-driven approach. I guess this presents a bit more of an opportunity to use more judgment in setting assumptions. So we're going into a world where there's likely very little data on experience with commission rates like this. And it's likely that insurers have gone through some exercise on the pricing side to develop assumptions for pricing purposes. And this presents an opportunity to use some of that judgment on the valuation side as well. Now, the length of the investigation period and the multi-dimensional and multi-period analysis are two tools that are likely to help identify whether there is any sort of structural change in the lapse experience. And in terms of the last one, I'll just run through a quick example of a simple piece of analysis that might help insurers to identify whether experience pre and post LIF is significantly different. So just to walk you through it, this is somewhat similar to a typical setup for a lapse investigation performed in 2016. Say it's 4 years of experience. So this is effectively saying we've got an average experience during 2016. At the moment, we're lucky enough to have a simple pre-LIF world, admittedly not as simple as everything being on 1-10-10, but let's pretend it is for now. Moving along, the water's going to start to get a little bit more muddy. So in 2017, we've got a potentially 1 year's worth of LIF experience coming through. And then rolling that forward, by the time we get to 2019, we've got a mixed bag of different things. And exposure for a post-LIF world is going to start to increase and have an actual impact on the results. Now, of course, the other key method that insurers use to analyse experience is by policy duration. So you can see, particularly at policy duration one, by the time we get to 2019, we're looking at four different commission structures, each potentially with different lapse experience. So it gets a little bit more complicated, and this effect will take a number of years before it works its way out of the experience investigation. Now, what's potentially a good idea to help identify whether there is that structural change is simply to split it into something like a pre-LIF, post-LIF. And then potentially there's room to further delve into that and see whether during the transition period itself the experience differs by commission structure. Of course, recognising that the deeper you go, the less data there's going to be to actually analyse, but it could be used to identify indicative trends and indicative differences. And effectively, this sort of analysis can help insurers to appreciate whether there has been a difference, and then using some of the judgment, insurers can I guess limit the lag of reflecting potential future experience in assumptions. So just to wrap up on the actuarial implications, we've made a number of observations and a couple of expectations. So firstly, there's uncertainty about the impact. Some benefit is expected to have already occurred, and whether there's further impact is uncertainty. There's a bit of a wait-and-see attitude amongst the industry, and there are expected to be, along with those that already exist, some additional challenges in analysing the experience. A number of opportunities are presented. Firstly, insurers can revisit and restructure experience studies in advance. Consider using more judgment or judgment from pricing in setting assumptions. Consider future regulatory changes. This might not be it, and Dale's going to touch on that in a minute. And effectively, all these opportunities roll up into avoiding to lag the experience. Thank you for that, and Dale will finish off with where to next.
Thanks, Tyson. So in terms of future directions, just wanted to start off by putting up a couple of international examples. Firstly, with South Africa there, who currently have caps on commission rates. In terms of the regulatory stance there, in 2014 there was proposals by the regulator to change those commission caps further and to take one step even further and prohibit commission on replacement policies, so basically make those fee for advice basis only. Now, they are just proposals, and the latest status update around those is that there's further work and refinement and discussion being had, but it just does give a bit of a sense of what else is happening. And, you know, that Australia is not the only country in which the regulator is looking to take measures to reduce the incentive to churn business. So, as we touched on earlier, you know, could a change of government send us in a different direction? Well, possibly, but the... You know, broadly, there's support from both major parties around LIF. I'd be surprised if there was major changes to those proposals before they are put into legislation. But depending on which government takes us through the next 3 years, there may be moves to strengthen those further under a Labor government, potentially. In any case, I think all insurers are pretty much ready, set, go in terms of implementing the changes in systems as and when they are required to. So the one I wanted to spend a little bit more time talking about is the ASIC review in 2018. So ASIC intend to gather data from insurers over the next couple of years to inform their review, and they've already stated that they'll look at lapse rates, clawbacks, distribution profiles and the like. And they've also stated their intention to work with industry regarding the collection of that data in order to make it as informative as possible, but also as practical an exercise as possible. I do want to talk about the challenges that process will pose. As I mentioned earlier, the statement from government at the moment is that if there's not significant improvement in customer outcomes, then they'll look back towards the recommendation in the financial systems inquiry around level commissions. So there's a very clear need as an industry in order to avoid that outcome, to do its best to show significant improvement over this period. As I say, that poses significant challenges because what does success look like? Is it about less churn? Is it about less non-compliant advice? Is it about lower premiums for customers? You know, as we said earlier, that's not necessarily an outcome that's looking likely at the moment. Another clear challenge is that we don't really have a fixed definition of what churn is. It's been debated for years. So how are we going to measure it? How are we going to show that there's been improvement? That's clearly a challenge. In terms of available data among insurers' systems, what can be measured may not necessarily be relevant to the question, and vice versa. So we saw with ASIC's treatment of their initial exercise in 2014, they leapt to some fairly bold conclusions around advisor behaviour and the best way to address it from what was, a fairly small sample of data that they collected at the time. And they drew a strong link between advisor behaviour and commission structures. So to some extent, I do worry about how the available data and the available analysis might be interpreted in 2016. And then lastly, a clear challenge is the time frame. So even if LIF was implemented from 1 July 2016, which we're saying is looking like it's delayed, so many policies are still in the clawback period by the time the review is needing to be done. So the transition to the final state is not complete. We're not seeing the fullness of the effect of those reforms come through. So it does raise the question of whether further regulation or further movement away from a upfront style of commission will be inevitable or not. And if it does happen, it has quite stronger impacts on advisors and insurers. So we'll leave it there and open it up to questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Dale and Tyson. So that was very interesting. Anyone want to take the first question? Great, thank you.
Hi, Greg Martin. Couple of quick questions. We talked a lot about lapses. I've got a lot of comments I could make on that because we talk a lot about churn. I don't know how many actuaries actually talk to advisors in the real world because, in particular, we love those graphs that show low lapse rates in the first year and people say, oh, that's because of current clawback. Everyone seems to forget that 40% of the business that's sold in the IFA world is actually annual premium. There is no lapse in the first year. And the sticker shock happens for all of us when we get our first renewal where the premium goes up. So I would have thought, by definition, your lapse pattern's always going to be that up and drop off simply because that's the way of the world. More important question is, if we're going to get lower lapses and you reckon it's all because of churn, then that means your new business is going to drop for the industry. What does that mean for acquisition costs in the industry? Are we going to stack MDs because we don't need 20% of their time? Are we going to not stop spending money on all the IT, which is all fixed costs? Are you going to have less BDMs in the industry chasing a smaller pool? Or is it really we're going to get rid of one male boy and the most junior underwriter in our business, in which case expenses at the top, same number of policies on the denominator bigger, and your acquisition costs go up. I actually haven't seen too many people talking about some of this aspects of the impact on the business, and it, where it ends up could be quite perverse. So I'll just leave that as a sort of statement, question, or how you want to interpret it.
Thanks, Greg. So broadly, yeah, in agreement with those points, and it really, I guess, puts the impetus on insurers to find ways to improve productivity to make this all work, and to avoid, you're alluding to, I guess, basically an increase in per unit acquisition costs. So it needs to flow through to some kind of productivity improvement to make this all work.
Alan Merton's my name. I'm not going to respond totally to Greg's comments, but one thing I will say, in lots of other markets where commission levels have come down, one of the findings is that the distributors still need to make an income, and even though they're receiving less per dollar of sale, they actually tend to raise their own productivity to achieve a level of income. Now, obviously, the intentions of these reforms is better outcomes in terms of the customer, and I think everybody agrees with that. So hopefully that's not just finding new ways to churn, whatever we define churn as. So I'm a bit more optimistic about the industry finding, and not just the manufacturers finding the answer, but the distributors finding the answer too. The theme of the conference is reimagining the future, and I really like the scenarios you were talking about and the way of thinking about what might happen. I'm interested in the ways actuaries can impact the future, and rather than just tracking and watching experience, I'm interested in how actuaries help to drive the outcomes that actually are better for the industry. I'm not sure whether you can comment on what you're seeing with companies trying to help distributors with thinking about customer experience process, distributor experience process, the tools that are used, and the products that we're actually selling, and all of that being part of driving a future that looks better rather than just responding to a set of requirements that we think are going to come in at some point in time.
It's a very good question. I would say that a lot of the activity so far has been around responding and complying, and less about, you know, creating a better future outcome, you know, adapting products and so forth. That's, I guess, something that will hopefully develop over time once the regulation settles down and we know what, you know, where the goalposts are and so forth.
And I guess just to add on to that, retention at the other end of the spectrum is becoming much more of a focus for insurers. So we're seeing over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, retention teams are being set up and formalised, and that's expected to continue improving to hopefully hold on to the policies that they are writing.
Just a follow-up question. Do you see the shape of the industry changing in terms of, obviously, life insurance is more than just retail advice, that we have group, we have direct products, and potentially there's a space in between. Do you see kind of the composition changing in terms of how we can best service customers with insurance, given that advisors now, they've, I guess, without anything changing in terms of efficiencies, have the same cost of advice, but now at least up front are finding it harder to cover their costs?
I think with the LIF reforms as they stand at the moment, you know, there's that potential to adapt and make that work. If reforms go further and push towards a level commission or fee for advice only basis, then it does squeeze out, I guess, the traditional advice model. And create more fertile ground for something in between.
Thanks. Hi, Warwick Hearn. I'd just like to comment and raise a question about distribution. I work with a lot of advisors and I talk to a lot of advisors, and I would say that over the next 12 months or so, we're going to see a massive exit of older advisors from the community at large. And in my time in the industry, I've seen a significant shift away from risk advice to wealth advice in that community of people. And so what we're seeing now is a massive reduction in the amount of risk being sold. I'm almost embarrassed to explain this, but when I joined the industry, I joined a super fund and was instantly insured for seven times my salary. The My Super legislation now sets that at $40,000. How did we let that happen? I don't understand how we allowed that sort of massive societal change to take place. And so, frankly, I'm really concerned about the enormous reduction in people actually selling risk. I welcome the direct activities, but they just won't work across the community as a whole. They'll make a difference, but not enough. And so I'm seriously concerned that we are charging down a direction which is going to significantly reduce the amount of risk in our community and society are going to suffer. So, you know, it's interesting to discuss some of these things. I happen to favour level commission myself because I think that gets the right sort of outcomes. And yes, we need to help advisors transition to that, but they will then be better off because their businesses will be worth more because their businesses are valued on recurring revenue. And so, you know, there's a transition there to be had that I'm not afraid of, but I am concerned that we're going to get a massive reduction in the sheer sales effort. And that will reflect on the industry and the community at large.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't disagree with those observations. I mean, I think what's important is the education piece for advisors, and a lot of that should be around the fact that if retention is used as a key driver, that the total stream of commissions is likely to be very similar or even better. But yeah, I mean, I certainly don't disagree. And if we do move to eventually a more level commission, then it might reduce further. What is important is around that education piece is, I guess, aligning the remuneration with the level of work that the advisors are doing. I mean, as we know, it's a lot more work to write a policy than it is to keep one for the advisor. So yeah, I mean, the benefit will be for advisors to have a long term view.
Mark Burr. Following on from what Warwick was saying, if these commission structures are reduced and leads to IFAs sort of all filtering out or a large reduction or just becoming not really possible for them to offer their services for and continue getting remunerated as they want, do you think that's going to start pushing the robo-advice model or pushing people towards that type of lower cost or lower fee-for-service type model?
I think inevitably there'll be a push towards improving productivity in the process and whether that's using some form of robo-advice for part of that process or you know, automating in some way, you know, some collection of information and, you know, initial view around the advice. It'll be an evolving process, I imagine, and you know, something around robo-advice, I think, would likely be part of that.
Hi, Tim Harbell. My question is about longer duration policies, so particularly legacy policies, and advisor responsibilities under best interest about those policies being relevant and up to date. So not so much an incentive question, but is a measure of success perhaps that people who have had policies for 10 or 15 years actually do lapse them, if that's in the best interest of the client to have a more up to date policy?
Yeah, it kind of gets to a point of, you know, what are we trying to achieve with these reforms, and what does success look like? It's very much tackling, as you say, the incentives, but there's a whole range of other outcomes down the track. I think how it'll play out for customers really depends on that insurer's upgrade philosophy. you know, whether they're passing back benefit improvements to those customers that have been with them for 10 years in the same policy. So I think that sort of upgrade philosophy needs to tie into wherever this heads. If it does involve customers hanging on to their policies for much longer or being in product structures which encourage them to be in that policy for much longer.
It's interesting, Dale, you talk about incentives, and I guess it's really trying to align the advisor's incentives to the customers. But then, Tyson, you were also saying that over the long term, the commission structure that the advisors will get is pretty much just as good, if not better, than they can get today. It seems like there's a business model shift that's needed to look at for dealer groups, and would definitely impact smaller independent dealer groups differently to a larger organisational-owned dealer group. And I guess it also ties into some of the discussion we had on APLs and opening those. What do you see as the impact on maybe consolidation of dealer groups or how... what dealer groups will win in this environment?
Tricky question. There's still a lot of moving parts, and particularly with the APL question, you know, that's unknown at this stage as to how far that will go. If APLs are forced to widen significantly, it really does change, I guess, the structure of what a licensee needs to do and how they support their advisors. So I find it a little bit tricky to answer at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds like even more important to have efficiency if you're now looking at a broader range of insurers, and that's an extra burden at the same time as the commission to cover that burden's going down.
I mean, some level of consolidation is almost inevitable because, I mean, as you pointed out, it will be harder for the single advisor that's got his own shop and that's about it. It will be less of a burden on the big dealer groups. So whether they absorb some of the loan ranges, we'll see. We may well see play out.
Awesome. Well, another question close to my heart. I'm from a reinsurer, Pacific Life Re, and I'm interested in the impact on reinsurance. And I guess the clawback period has changed for the insurer in terms of their funding model. But I guess traditionally, reinsurers have always supported in the retail market 100% upfront reinsurance commission. And I'm just wondering whether you think that there will be a shift in how the relationship between the reinsurer and the insurer will change, similarly to how the relationship between the upfront costs the insurer is paying out to the dealer groups.
That might depend on how good the reinsurers are at negotiating. obviously the P&L strain may well or will likely change for the insurers. Ideally, the reinsurers will get some of that benefit as well. Whether that plays out or not, I'm not sure. Dale, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, so the acquisition costs for the direct insurer change, and whether that reinsurance commission structure changes alongside of it will determine how, the lapse risk is shared in the future. At the moment, how it's shared is not necessarily, you know, evenly split, but in the end it's more of a negotiation on an individual basis. I would say
so. Unless anyone else has another question, I'm going to ask one more. I could keep going all day, please stop me.
Hi, Alvin Lee here from JP Morgan. Just a quick question. You've mentioned that obviously, the reforms are likely going to be passing in some form or another with the bipartisan support, but just in terms of timing, it's probably a bit uncertain. If the reforms will be passed, say, a year later or any time further down the track, do you think insurers will be adopting these new commission structures before the passing of the reforms? So obviously, they've want to have these reforms in place. They've done a lot of work on it. But on the other hand, there's a lot of competitive pressures, where you can't really just, you know, you don't really want to be the first one to implement these. So I just want to see where you stand on this and just get your views.
Yeah, so 100% agree that the competitive pressures will take precedence, and I don't see insurers moving early on it until something is actually legislated.
Which is unfortunate because, as you said, insurers are pretty much ready to hit the go button, and they've put a lot of work into, you know, the changes that are being made throughout the products and that sort of thing. So hopefully we do see something come through somewhat resembling what we think.
Okay, if you could all join me in thanking Dale and Tyson.